Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to August's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies based at the University of Edinburgh, Emma Keeble. Thank you, Emma. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Emma. It's a pleasure to be invited to speak at this webinar, and thank you for joining us today. I'm hoping that you will find that this is an informative webinar for you, and hopefully we'll get a chance to cover some of the more basic things that you might want to be doing with hospitalised rabbits, but also look at some of the more advanced techniques and have a discussion, if need be, about those. So, we will get on with this, and as I say, thank you for joining us today. I think that rabbits in particular are interesting cases because they do have relatively unique biology compared to obviously our more domesticated species. One thing we need to really be thinking about is the fact that they have very large hindguts, and this can lead to problems if they stop eating with fermentation and gas buildup. We have a combined urogenital opening, so similar to, I guess, to dogs and cats, you may not know where any bleeding is coming from. And often with rabbits, you know, there are many different sizes and different breeds, and this can lead to differences in how we actually treat those animals. Certainly the large breeds will need more space when they're hospitalized, and also can be in some ways more interesting in their behavior. They can be more difficult to handle as well. So I'm hopeful that, you know, when we're all hospitalizing rabbits, we're aware that obviously these are prey species and they will get very, very stressed easily by being next to a dog or a cat. And certainly we are very lucky at Edinburgh. We do have a separate ward for our rabbits. It's still not ideal. You can still hear noise. There are people coming in and out. This is an area that I think, you know, we really need to improve on generally in veterinary practice. If we have got an isolation area where we can keep these animals, that will benefit them greatly. We also very much encourage rabbits to be brought in with their companion animal. Now, this will obviously depend on a case-by-case basis, but if the companion is there, we do find that animals are more likely to eat and show normal behavior. Now, this obviously can be difficult then to assess what the animal is doing, perhaps in terms of passing droppings or urine, but a period apart can help with this. And it is very important to be able to express their normal natural behaviors, and certainly knowing the normal for rabbits is important, and that's where we can really employ our nursing staff, and they can be a great help and benefit to that. So I think when looking at rabbit patients, we need to think about our physiological data. And I think knowing what is normal, perhaps for that individual in particular, is essential. And this is where I use, you know, the hospitalization sheet a lot. When an animal comes into us, we will take a normal temperature so that we know what the sort of range is for that animal. And it's amazing how varied temperatures can be. I mean, obviously, if that animal's very ill, it may be low. But a normal temperature is really important to take, and that's something that I think in the past we haven't actually emphasized very much. I always take a heart rate and respiratory rate. Again, it amazes me how often these are elevated, but when they come in and once they've settled, they may then reduce. But if they don't, we might be dealing with respiratory disease, and this is something that is commonly missed, I think, in practice. Anything sort of over 80 respiratory rate, I'm starting to be a little bit concerned. Now, that could be stress, obviously, but we need to determine that once the animal has hopefully settled and become more accustomed to its hospitalization. We will also record daily food and water consumption. This is actually measured in mils and grams. Everything is weighed. And also we'll try and make an assessment of fecal and urinary output, you know, an approximation of the number of droppings that have been passed, the size, and whether they're irregular or not. And that's really vital to monitor in rabbits. One thing I find really difficult is, you know, assessment of pain in rabbits. And the bottom picture that's in your presentation here, this rabbit actually had a fractured leg but was just sitting in the corner of its cage. And this can be really, really difficult in rabbits to assess. That's why I think taking as thorough history as possible, making your clinical examination really thorough, and then, you know, taking those vital parameters and seeing if we've got elevations is absolutely key and essential in rabbit cases. Even despite that, it always amazes me the type of conditions that we can see where owners haven't really noticed actually that the animal is in any way affected. I had a rabbit just a few weeks ago that actually had severe osteomyelitis involving its tympanic bulla, and there had, to the owner's mind, been no clinical signs of this. So what can we do as vets to try and determine whether an animal is in pain? Certainly an animal that's sitting at the back of a cage, that's hiding, that's not really relaxed and doing normal rabbit behavior is of a concern. Often respiratory rates are increased and breathing can become more labored. Associated with this as well, we sometimes see elevations in temperature and heart rate as well, although that can be difficult because as soon as you get your hands onto your auscultator rabbit, often the heart rate does increase. Other sort of fairly nondescript signs, teeth grinding, perhaps stretching out if there's abdominal pain, and certainly a reduced appetite, and perhaps over time weight loss can be other indicators that an animal is in some degree of discomfort. And when I was thinking about this presentation, I was trying to think, what are the common things that I see that cause pain in rabbits? Now, often as an end presentation, we get a rabbit coming in with gastrointestinal stasis. But what we need to be thinking is, why has that animal stopped eating, gone into gut stasis? This is probably a secondary thing. Have we got something else going on in this case? And a lot of the time that is what is happening. Obviously, we are all very much aware of dental disease and the issues associated with that in rabbits. So that was pretty much top of my list. We might also have a rabbit that has generally just got gastrointestinal pain, and certainly gas buildup, tympany, perhaps, you know, blockages, they will cause pain as well. More and more with aged rabbits, we're seeing animals with musculoskeletal disease, arthritis, spondylosis of the spine, and this is something in our older rabbit population that we do need to think about. I do feel that urinary tract disease can lead to gut stasis as well, and certainly when you see urinary tract disease, you might see other associated urinary signs. One thing that is very much underdiagnosed that I feel we need to be looking at far more routinely is ear disease in rabbits. The bottom picture here shows you an animal postoperatively that's had a lateral bulla osteotomy. This is something that some individuals won't show much sign associated with it, but others will have pain when you palpate the area of the base of the ear, or perhaps have reduced appetite or be favoring chewing on one side. So it is something that I think is very much underdiagnosed in practice and that we need to be very much aware of as rabbit vets. So where do we start? Well, certainly looking at the animal, how it's behaving within your consultation at a distance is always a good place. And quite often as the animal comes into my consultation room, I'll get the animal out, chat to the owner, and hopefully it will start to hop around the floor and show fairly normal behavior. Now, an animal that just sits or has obviously respiratory distress, you know, I'm far more concerned about that individual. One thing we can also look at is obviously general body condition, and that is also key. In an animal that's been losing weight successively, you know, we always weigh every rabbit that comes in. That could be a sign of pain over time, obviously chronic pain we're thinking about in this case. when we come to actually examine our animals, we do need to know what is normal. We need to be careful with the examination technique. We don't obviously want to cause any more pain or for that animal to be injured whilst handling. And we need to be very systematic in our examination. And so I tend to start from head to tail, but you know, you may want to do that differently. First of all, I will take my physiological data. I'll get a respiratory rate, heart rate, temperature, weight, and our body condition score. So those are five things that I do initially, and then we start from the head end back and look at all body systems. Palpation of lymph nodes is something that people often miss, and I think is also very important, particularly if we've got ear-based abscesses or facial abscesses. These may be enlarged. Normally we shouldn't be feeling rabbit lymph nodes. They're pretty tiny, but if they are enlarged, then this could be significant. I want to put that picture in of the pram. We get animals brought in all sorts of different containers and carriers. This is one client who has adopted a pram for her rabbit, and the rabbits seem to very much enjoy it, but it always causes great sort of excitement when they come in with that amongst the students, because they quite like to see a rabbit being pushed around in a pink pram. As I mentioned, these are the key things that I will first look at. I hadn't actually mentioned auscultation of the abdomen, but certainly five things, including also body condition score under weight, would be my initial things that I want to take in terms of getting that data immediately before the rabbit's perhaps too stressed, although quite often animals are already stressed by transport and waiting in your waiting area. Gut sounds is something that I will always auscultate and listen to. If you've got a very stressed animal, often these are absent. In theory, we should be listening for a minute, dorsally, minute ventrally, on both sides. In practice, this may not be possible just because of constraints of your consultation times, but certainly having a listen and seeing if those gut sounds are present. In cases of ileus, often they are absent, or in some cases you may have an increased borborygmy that you'll be hearing. Body temperature is really important, and we'll come to discuss this later, but certainly in cases where you've got animals that are not eating or GI stasis, often this is rapidly reduced, and that is quite a key diagnostic indicator. An animal that's very, very cold has a much poorer prognosis, and there have been recent papers about this in rabbits that have demonstrated that you know, temperature is absolutely vital. So please do start taking normal body temperatures in rabbits. So I was trying to think about what sort of emergencies we're likely to see, and the sort of things I see in practice, I hope are fairly similar to what you may be seeing. I think top of my list would be the gastrointestinal upsets. This can be anything from a sort of gastric bloat that could have occurred secondary to a change in appetite. We had one in just last week that had been fed a copious amount of wet cut grass, and this had led to fairly rapid gastric tympany. This could also be an impaction, and this is where you really need to be determining the difference between the two. If it's an impaction, it could be a surgical case, and it may well need fairly rapid intervention. We also do commonly see cecal tympany and impaction, often not together, maybe usually it's one or the other. But again, determining where your gas buildup is on clinical exam is absolutely vital to managing the case and moving forwards. We had a liver lobe torsion just last week, and this is something that can result in very acute blood loss and collapse. Often the rabbit will present looking very, very pale, so assessment of mucous membrane colour is absolutely key. This could also occur with an acute bleed in a reproductive disorder. And again, I've had a venous aneurysm fairly recently in a female rabbit that was entire, that bled into its uterus. So thinking about acute blood loss and causes is another common emergency that we do see. We are also seeing a lot of respiratory disease in pet rabbits, and certainly thoracic Thymomas seem to be relatively common as rabbits get older and live longer. These animals will present with severe respiratory compromise, but this could also be secondary to infectious causes. Fight injuries, unfortunately, with the best will in the world, not all rabbits get on. And while animals are being introduced to each other, this is something that can commonly occur. We've also had pneumothorax cases where animals unfortunately have got under the feet of owners and by accident have been trodden on or kicked, or in some way there's been an impact injury and this has resulted in a pneumothorax. And obviously fractures, you know, is another possible result. We still do quite regularly, sadly, see spinal fractures in animals. We had one a month ago that an owner had put out into the garden. It then was found an hour later with unable to use its hind limbs. So unfortunately, still a relatively common thing that we're seeing. And then I just was thinking about young animals and you know, diarrhea and fluid loss, obviously in young animals is quite an important emergency that you might be seeing in practice. So there's quite a range of things that can happen, and obviously this is the same as in other species, but it's how we then go on to deal with that animal that is absolutely key. So here's a picture of a rabbit that I had in just a few weeks ago. Hopefully you can all see that mucous membrane colour is really, really pale. So start looking in every rabbit that comes through so that you know what's normal for the species. I do find that the ocular mucous membranes are quite useful, but I also always turn the rabbit over, look at the perineal area, and you can look at the mucous membranes of the vulva or the prepuce, and that's another area that often will show quite severe pallor. You can have a look in the mouth as well, but some rabbits will resent this. So what sort of basic baseline diagnostic tests are we taking? I mean, obviously, this is not exhaustive. There may be other tests that you find useful. I was chatting with colleagues quite recently, and certainly we're going to start looking at lactate levels as well in rabbits, particularly with GI stasis. I do, as fairly routine in my GI stasis rabbits, take blood glucose levels, and interestingly, these are often elevated. Now, there has been a paper that indicates that if it's over 20 or so, we need to be looking at surgical treatment. However, we have had cases that have been very, very high that have, with time and supportive care and intensive fluid therapy, resolved. So although you might have a pyloric foreign body, sometimes these will pass through and you need to be monitoring those cases very, very closely, and certainly radiographs need to be taken to determine whether it's likely to be a surgical case or not. Electrolytes, as in dogs and cats, may be up or down. There can be great variety of different changes to those. And I would always take a PCV and total protein as well in any sort of collapsed or hypothermic rabbit. We might be wanting to take urea creatinine and certainly perhaps a fresh blood smear just to have an assessment of white blood cell count is quite useful too. I am using pulse oximetry a lot in rabbits, particularly the rabbits with the respiratory disease, and it's quite shocking how low their pulse oximetry readings can be, 80% or so with rabbits with thymomas. So I think that is another thing that we can very quickly clip onto the rabbit's ear. Usually we shave a little area and we can use that very, very quickly to determine how severe this rabbit's respiratory disease is. Again, urinalysis is absolutely vital, and it's something we can very quickly and easily collect. A lot of our pet rabbits are litter trained and will pass urine into a litter tray once they're hospitalized. And then certainly radiography is still a very useful tool, particularly with GI stasis cases. And this is something we can do fairly quickly in a conscious animal. We're not having necessarily to sedate them because we will get information from that fairly quickly. And I think the next slide after this is a picture that I want to show you of a gastric tympani case, and we can just talk about that in a minute. I hope very much that most of you are really happy with how you would take a blood sample in a rabbit and what your maximum volume would be. You can get a very small amount of blood from an ear vein in a rabbit, but we tend to routinely use the saphenous vein. So the lateral saphenous vein is readily accessible. All of our animals get clipped and then Emla local anaesthetic cream applied to the area. We usually like to leave them for a minimum of 30 minutes, ideally a little bit longer with that cream, and then we would be taking samples after that. Some rabbits for the lateral saphenous vein will lie quite happily in lateral recumbency. It depends very much, obviously, on the individual. But in other cases, we'll be having them in sternal recumbency with the leg just suspended over the table. It's really important, obviously, to take great care of the spine when you're holding a rabbit like this. And certainly this picture here, I'd probably be leaning over the rabbit to sort of provide some restraint so that the spine itself was not likely to be twisted. As I mentioned, radiography is absolutely key. This was a rabbit that we radiographed just last week that had a really severely distended stomach. This case was not a surgical case in the end. It had eaten a large amount of food and it was just taking time for the food to move through. You can see that there is quite a large amount of material within the cecum. A little bit of gas, but that's fairly normal. But then we do have these large distended bowel loops as well here. And here is the outline, obviously, of the stomach. Just to note, we've also got some biliary mineralization, which was thought to be incidental in this case, although we did later scan its liver. So this is a rabbit that had intensive supportive therapy and IV fluids and gentle abdominal massage, and within 24 hours had reduced in size. I would normally be repeating radiography, perhaps hourly, depending on the case, because I'm not wanting this to progress any further because it potentially could have been surgical. So what sort of supportive care and initial therapy do we need with these sort of emergency cases that we're admitting? Obviously, with any case, we want to stabilize them first. And I'll come on to some of the procedures that you might be wanting to perform. I do think it's very key to have a quiet area. I think stress is really underestimated in clinical practice. And if we can at all keep these animals away from dogs and cats and barking and noise, I think that's absolutely key. And then we do need to provide high fiber diet. So even if our rabbits are placed into an incubator, then we are putting in food, water, hay, so they've got access at all times to that. And it's amazing, even very sick rabbits will start to pick up a piece of hay and chew if it's there in front of them. It's almost like sometimes you get aggressive chewing because they're perhaps cross with you and they pick up the hay and sort of break it in half with their incisors, but you know that can then lead on to them actually eating. My sort of cutoff point, we talked about temperature earlier, normally in rabbits 38.5, it can go a little bit higher than that. Anything below 37 and I put it in an incubator and I'm starting to get worried below 37. Animals that are presenting at 36, 35 are severely ill, and this is worth reiterating to the owner that I'd be very, very worried about that individual at that sort of temperature. We're all aware of fluid therapy in rabbits. I put this slide in because this is actually a very old slide, and this is how we used to administer IV fluids to rabbits. In my mind, that's actually very stressful. We've got an Elizabethan collar, we've got an IV line attached. Often these get tangled around the rabbit's legs. We've got a flow meter as well and an infusion pump. But how we tend to do it now is that we'll place an IV catheter and then we'll give boluses so that the rabbit doesn't actually have to be restrained and doesn't have to be attached to fluids for any length of time, because if they're moving around, you do very rapidly find that the line will get tangled and perhaps pulled out. And certainly also we've had a lot of rabbits that have chewed through the line, and then there's a high risk that they will bleed from the catheter. So a bolus is given very slowly and calculated, and this seems to work very well even in very sick patients. I will come on to speak about analgesia and GI motility drugs. As I mentioned earlier, pulse oximetry and checking oxygenation saturation levels in rabbits is key, and any animal that I'm concerned about would go into an incubator with humidified oxygen straight away, and this will rapidly make a difference in these cases. So we recheck with the pulse oximeter and see how that's going in oxygen, and very rapidly you'll find that their oxygen saturation levels improve. I put probiotics in brackets. It's something that we sometimes use, particularly with GI cases that are exhibiting diarrhea. It's something just to think about in rabbits, and some people like using them, some don't. It really depends on your personal preference. It's not going to cause any problems, and it might well, I guess, you know, help with normal gut flora. I think what's far more important really is thinking about a high fiber diet and nutritional support, and that's where, again, we need to be quite aggressive with our feedings and working out our volumes and how much we're going to give. Hopefully you're very aware of all the different recovery diets that are out there, and I've just put a few on this slide to give you sort of a general idea. Some rabbits will very much like an individual diet, and if they're not eating well, it's worth trying a different one with them. And we stock a range of products so that we can, you know, basically determine what the rabbit likes best, you know, by trying perhaps a few different types. And I would really, really emphasize that giving a tiny amount into the mouth is key. I did have a rabbit last week that had been fed by a student that the mouth had been filled with food and the rabbit had not actually been swallowing. So that was absolutely fine, luckily, but if this had continued, then fairly quickly the rabbit wouldn't have been able to breathe and we could have been at risk of an aspiration. So something to talk to your nurses about, and make sure that the animals are actually swallowing before we continue to put food into their mouths. It is relatively straightforward. This picture is just showing an assisted feeding in a rabbit. It can take quite a lot of time. We have much smaller catheter tip syringes now that are actually useful for smaller rabbits and for smaller volumes, and perhaps a little bit easier to depress as well. One thing I always ask my nurses as well is to make sure that they clean the rabbit afterwards, because, you know, quite often you get food stuck around the mouth and that can lead to over-grooming and can be irritant as well. Thinking about fluid therapy, obviously we've got all these different routes, and hopefully you are fairly good at gaining IV access in all your rabbits. I tend not to use intraperitoneal at all in pet rabbits now, and that's something that perhaps comes more from laboratory animal medicine. We always also need to think about our subcutaneous routes as well as peros. In a really debilitated rabbit, if we can't get IV access, then giving warm subcutaneous fluids could be absolutely key, and then we can maybe get an IV catheter in. And we actually add a collagenase enzyme, hyaluronidase, to our fluids to hopefully break down collagen, increase absorption of fluids through the subcutaneous route, and also make sure that those fluids are warmed. Hopefully you're all aware of maintenance requirements now. I tend to calculate these with students at 100 mils per kilo per day and then divide them into my boluses of fluids that I'm going to give over the period of the 24 hours. You can add in obviously your percentage dehydration to that based on your clinical assessment as well. But we can also give high dose shock volumes as in other species. So, you know, in an animal that you're really concerned about, giving, you know, a bolus very quickly at high doses can save a life. This is just showing IV catheter placement into the cephalic vein. So something just to think about. It's not one I routinely use, but it's an alternative if you're having problems with ear veins. This is just showing the saphenous vein. We also place catheters into this vein. It's quite a large vein, but it does blow fairly easily, and we can get hematomas developing. There's the catheter placement, and just checking that a catheter is patent. And then obviously we would put a bandage over that to prevent the rabbit from chewing out the catheter. I think fairly routinely we use the marginal ear vein, and this may be something that you are all using yourselves. I thought it might be useful just to show you how we place the actual catheter and what sort of support structures we put there as well. Sometimes we'll warm the ear if we've got a rabbit that's very debilitated and cold, and that can help. And that's something that's worth thinking about. So we're clipping the ear here and placing Emla cream on the marginal area. I usually clip both ears just in case, because we've got students obviously who are placing catheters, and that can be helpful. And we also have quite a nice vein that runs on the anterior aspect. So I'm trying to get the arrow to move here. There we go. Along here. Watch out, obviously, for the central artery, but along this edge of the ear, there's also quite a nice vein as well, that if you can't get the marginal ear vein because it's had multiple catheters, that's something to think about. This is us just warming the ear. And then, obviously, we've got a lovely vein there to place our catheter in. Placement of the catheter is relatively straightforward, and hopefully, again, you're fairly aware of how to go about this. It's very superficial. It always surprises me how superficial rabbit ear veins are. And then once we've actually placed and put a bung in, we've basically held off that ear vein, and then we would put a T extension set or an injection port and a heparin flush. I placed a micropore underneath the catheter and then over the top to secure it. And then I place a rolled swab within the ear itself to act as a sort of stent to keep the ear upright. This is us placing that in there. And then we put the tape around the whole ear. And that seems to work very well, and it's relatively lightweight, and rabbits don't seem to bother too much with that. And this is us just placing some soft ban, and then we'll vet wrap it and obviously give our boluses of fluids. Just a word of warning, you do occasionally get ears that have been repeatedly used for this process, and you can get necrosis. It is very rare, and hopefully it's not something we'll see too often, but we do need to be removing our catheters fairly regularly and replacing them and alternating ears and sites as well. So that takes us on to intraosseous catheter placement. This is something that we will use certainly if we've got an animal that's very debilitated, is in shock, has got collapsed veins, and we're not able to place an IV catheter. Sites that you can use are listed there. I tend to prefer either the tibia or actually the proximal, the greater trochanter of the femur. It does require general anaesthesia because obviously it's going to be very painful, and we do have to be aseptic in our technique. I do provide analgesia as well in these cases. So this is us just preparing the site. The animal's already sedated, anaesthetized. This might be something that you want to place if you've done other procedures and you're wanting to get fluids in either during that or post-operatively. We're then placing our needle and stylet with a sort of drilling action down through into the bone. There should be initial resistance, and then you'll find it easily passes through into the medulla. And obviously, just with other species, we want to make sure that we flush it and keep it as sterile as possible, bandage it in place. And usually I would confirm that we're in the right place with radiography as well. This is just a picture showing us actually placing that catheter, sorry, stilet and catheter. And then once that's placed, usually I'd like to check that the leg moves freely and that the catheter is actually moving with it as well. And that should be flushed, and then we would tape and bandage that in. This is us flushing the catheter and just checking that we have a patent catheter. And then rabbits do seem to tolerate them fairly well. They don't tend to chew them out, particularly the individuals that we're placing these in. They're often very debilitated, so we can give very quick, immediate fluids to that animal. Nasogastric tube placement, again, is something that if we've got an animal that's not eating well, we might want to consider. And it is surprisingly well tolerated in pet rabbits. It's very important to pre-measure your tube, and this is something that I often forget to do. So do place the tube against the side of the animal, pre-measure before you actually start to place this into the nasal area. This is us just spraying a local anaesthetic into this rabbit's nose, because it can be very, rabbits are very, very sensitive with their nasal mucosa, and it can be quite irritant to rabbits as you place the tube, and they can react even if they're sedated. I wouldn't do this on a conscious rabbit. I think really you need to have some form of sedation, because they really don't tolerate it well. But if you place local anaesthetic actually into the nasal cavity and potentially also sterilely place some local anaesthetic gel over the very tip of the tube, then that can help as well. This is us pre-measuring. This is something I often forget to do, but really, really vital. We usually pre-measure down to the sort of caudal rib on the left side, and that gives you an indication of how far you need to place your tube down. And here we are placing the tube. We're aiming sort of medially and ventrally in this animal. And what we must do once we've actually sutured the tube in place is confirm radiographically that we are in the right place. Rabbits don't tend to cough, so there is the potential that you could have intubated the rabbit with this. Now, you can try aspiration, you can listen to the end of the tube, but I think radiographic confirmation of placement is absolutely key if you have placed a nasogastric tube. And I do like to suture them in, because you do find sometimes rabbits will try and scratch these out. Sometimes we do also have to resort to Elizabethan collars, but we're hoping to avoid that if possible. Here we are giving some fluids, and this rabbit, you know, obviously if they're eating brilliantly, but if they're not, this can be really important and can help be life-saving. I wanted also to cover blood transfusion in pet rabbits. This is something that more and more, unfortunately, we are having to perform. It is relatively straightforward, and if you have a donor rabbit, often, you know, owners have two rabbits, hopefully they're kept as companions. You may be able to get the other rabbit in to provide as a donor rabbit. And usually I try and collect an amount from each jugular from the donor rabbit, and then this is placed into your anticoagulant. And hopefully that slide gives you all the details of exactly what you're using and amount, so that you can use that yourself if you're having to do this procedure. So here's our donor rabbit clipped and emlid and ready. The jugular vein is very large in rabbits. It can be more difficult if there's a dewlap there, but generally rabbits do tolerate jugular blood sampling very well. What I usually do, I didn't say on that slide, but what I usually do is move the rabbits so that the front legs are just over the edge of the table, so that you've got space to actually remove a large volume of blood with your syringe. Otherwise, you might find with a large syringe it's difficult. Once we've actually got the blood from the donor, we're going to obviously make sure it's in the anticoagulant, it's kept warm, but we would immediately transfuse it into the rabbit that we're concerned about. There should be an IV catheter already placed, and it's really, really important to filter the blood as well. Here's just showing you, we're placing the filter over the end of our syringe and carefully filling the filter so there's no air bubbles there. And then I like to transfuse at a set rate and obviously at a maximum amount, watching very carefully in the first half an hour for any transfusion reactions. A first transfusion in theory should be okay, but obviously we want to be really, really careful. And we do use you know, this setup as seen in the picture here, so that we can do it very slowly and in a controlled way. We're also monitoring the rabbit's heart rate as well and respiratory rate while this is occurring. And that's the setup. It's all very straightforward. As you can see, someone sitting with that animal and it's slowly getting its blood transfusion. So moving on from sort of techniques that you might want to perform really to emergency therapies and drugs that you might want to give, there's a whole array of analgesics that we use now in pet rabbits. And this is a sort of field that is ever sort of evolving, really. as I mentioned before, it's really difficult because often you don't know whether a rabbit really is in pain or not. They don't show clear clinical signs, but I tend to be more preemptive with my analgesia and try and just assume that, you know, they probably are feeling some degree of pain, particularly with my GI cases. So, obviously, the opiates are drugs that we do tend to use, particularly in older rabbits. If I'm a little bit worried about the renal status of that animal, I might decide to go with an opiate in the first instance, although obviously with morphine methadone you may get GI side effects and respiratory depression at higher doses, so we need to be very aware of that in, you know, a debilitated animal. So I do tend to initially use perhaps buprenorphine, depending on the case obviously. Meloxicam we can use in conjunction. We tend to go for higher doses listed there twice daily, but again, be very careful if you've got an animal that's in pre-renal or renal failure. We don't want to be using this drug. And then I think something that we really overlook a lot in our rabbit cases is local anesthetics. And these are something we are routinely using in pet rabbits. Quite often we use both lidocaine and bupivacaine. So we're getting a short acting, very quick local anesthetic and then a longer acting 6 to 8 hour effect from the bupivacaine. This can be as a splash or it can be as a nerve block. And really I would urge you all to use these local anesthetics fairly routinely with your rabbit patients. I think there's been quite a trend recently to include these two drugs in our analgesic protocol. We are using tramadol a lot in pet rabbits. What I would say is that this is completely anecdotal. You know, anecdotally, we feel this makes a difference, but there have not been studies as to its effect and in particular side effects in pet rabbits. So although this is a drug you may want to use, and often what we'll do is change the animal from an injectable buprenorphine onto oral, perhaps tramadol, to go home, it's important to get signed consent because it's, you know, off license from owner, but also warn owner that, you know, really the side effects are unknown. And in people, they have been associated with, you know, side effects. So it is something we need to be aware of. We are also using gabapentin in cases of neuropathic pain. And again, these dose rates are anecdotal. But it does seem in some cases to make quite a difference. Again, something we are fairly routinely using in really severe cases post-surgery or during surgery is continuous rate infusion. So all our bulla osteotomies are given continuous rate infusion analgesia. We are tending more to do radiotherapy for thymomas, but in the days when we were doing surgical debulk of thymomas and thoracic surgery, CRIs would be absolutely used in these cases. I guess also if you had an animal presenting with severe fractures, this would be something we might want to consider as well. We do give usually a loading dose and then follow with sort of low doses as continuous rate infusion. Animals do need to be monitored very carefully as well. Now, I've got some dose rates in the next slide just to give you a sort of idea of the sort of doses that we're using. They are erring on the side of caution. We tend to go for sort of much lower doses. And obviously, if you've got a debilitated animal, you have to be very, very careful because you are adding in sedation as well. We also routinely use prokinetic drugs, and I'm hopeful that you are all using these in your rabbits in practice. They are very helpful and certainly do seem to make a big difference. I tend to, as routine, use ranitidine, and depending on the case and severity, whether it's BID or TID, but in conjunction with that, quite often like to use cisapride. You know, rather than metoclopramide, it is a little bit more superior in terms of its action across across the whole of the EGI tract rather than just more proximally as metoclopramide is. And don't forget that we can use domperidone as well. It is only primarily proximal in its action, but this is something that you could add in with your ranitidine and cisapride. I put this slide up. I mean, there are a whole array of things that you can add in as supportive care. I'm not greatly in favour of gut transformation or multivits, but you will see these sort of reported in the literature. Probiotics, again, if we've got a rabbit with diarrhoea, we might want to add this in. Or if you're worried about intestinal flora overgrowth, we might add some probiotics as well. Thinking about general nursing care, things that we should be reiterating to our veterinary nurses, we do get our rabbits out. Obviously, we need to disinfect between each animal, but daily exercise can really help rabbits in GI stasis. Quite often, they won't be passing any droppings. And if you get them out and they can move around, you do find that droppings will start to be passed. Every animal should have temperature, pulse and respiratory rate taken and be auscultated for gut sounds. And as I mentioned to you earlier, really rectal temperatures are absolutely key. It's something that has been shown to be a very useful parameter. We mentioned about cage mates, we mentioned about noise, reduce the handling of those animals and make sure that we do keep really good, accurate daily records. Weight is really, really important and can be very, very key. Things that we want to think about in terms of our nurses, I mean, I really rely on my vet nurses, you know, to let me know how cases are doing. I don't often have time to sit and watch and observe the animal, but vet nurses, even if just for a couple of minutes, they can sit and see what that animal's doing. If we've got a very relaxed animal that is, chewing a bit of hay, is moving around, then we may be happy. If the animal is literally sitting in a corner, it has elevated respiratory rate, there could well be concern. So making sure that our monitoring of inpatients is careful and thorough is absolutely essential. And I think possibly, well, I mean, obviously it's important in any animal species, but because rabbits are prey animals, they hide things. So it is really key in your rabbit patients. Things that we would always provide, obviously a hide area, make sure there's always hay in with any animal that comes in. We tend never to remove hay, even if we're going for an anaesthetic. We would potentially remove pellets or vegetable matter because obviously that could get impacted in the mouth and cause problems with intubation. But hay should always be there and the animals aren't starved at all prior to any GA. Make sure the diet that you're offering is obviously tempting. Whatever the rabbit likes to eat can be offered, but also sometimes they really go for things like these sort of garden herbs, basil, mint, coriander, and every animal that comes in gets a bowl full of water as well as a bottle. There was a really good paper that demonstrated that rabbits would drink 50% more from a bowl because it was easy access. So in our debilitated patients, it makes absolute sense to put a bowl in as well. This is the sort of cage setup that we have in our hospital. There isn't a hide area. I'd like to see a hide area and a litter tray in here as well. But we've got our daily record sheet and, you know, we're keeping a close eye and monitoring that animal. So we're almost at the end of the webinar and we've got a little bit of time now for any questions that people might have. And as we've been going through, actually, there have been a couple of questions that I'll talk through. Someone has actually asked about the blood transfusions, at what sort of percentage PCV I would consider doing a blood transfusion. I think it really does depend, obviously, on why the animal is needing a transfusion in the first place, and obviously getting your diagnostic tests and determining that is actually key. But if a PCV, falls below about 15%, I start to get very worried. We had an animal in this week that was 16% PCV, but was regenerative and total proteins were normal. So that animal has been monitored very closely, but not transfused. If it's below sort of 10%, then I definitely would do a blood transfusion. And it's amazing how quickly animals will pick up following that transfusion occurring. So I think, you know, as I say, it depends very much on the clinical case and the causes of. We need to be thinking about whether there is hemorrhage, internal or external, or whether there's hemolysis, intravascular, extravascular in these cases. And obviously you've got a similar protocol that you would follow as in your anemic dog and cat cases to determine the cause of the anemia. The other question I had, because we've been talking a little bit about body temperature, is whether I'm taking a temperature on every single rabbit patient that I see. Students often ask about this as well. I think I would absolutely take temperatures on a daily basis in rabbit patients, and if they're elevated or decreased, we would continue to monitor that through the day. I think it's very important to do it preoperatively as well, because we want to know what is normal for that particular animal. And as I said, it can be quite variable in rabbits, depending how stressed they are. So we would always make sure we take a pre-anesthetic temperature. We then know what we want the animal to get back up to following its anesthetic. In a GI stasis case, I always take rectal temperatures, and it's shocking actually how low they can be, even though the rabbit appears relatively well. So if you've got an animal that is looking pretty bright and owner's saying, well, it's not really eaten for a couple of hours, and then you take its temperature and it's 36, I would be warning the owner that this rabbit is rapidly going into shock and that it is a high-risk case, and I would be getting it warmed as soon as possible and starting IV fluid therapy. So do start taking temperatures. It's really quite helpful. And as I mentioned, there was quite a useful paper about this sort of looking at prognostic indicators, and temperature was a key one. I don't routinely take rabbit temperatures, rightly or wrongly, at vaccination. I think if the animal's bright, healthy, been eating, and we're doing a thorough clinical exam, then, you know, stressing the animal out by taking its temperature as well is probably not indicated. But if, as you're examining the animal, there are other causes for concern, then I would think about taking a temperature. So I hope that has answered most of the questions that have come up. If there are any more, please do type them in and I can answer. But I thank you very much for listening, and I hope that you have found the presentation useful today. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Emma for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.